This is Audible.
Wave Sound Audiobooks presents Under the Cold Bright Lights by Gary Disher. Narrated by Douglas Hansel. Chapter 1. On a mild October morning near Piersdale, southeast of Melbourne, a snake slid over the edge of a veranda on a shortcut to somewhere. Nathan Wright, blearily contemplating his parched lawn from the front door after breakfast, caught the movement in the corner of his eye. A big, fuck-off copperhead rippling over his veranda. Heading where? Towards his wife and daughter? Jamie was pegging jumpsuits to the clothesline on the side lawn, Serena Ray on a pink blanket at her feet. Finding his voice after a few seconds, weeks, Nathan pointed and squeaked, "Snake!" Jamie straightened from the clothes basket and followed his pointing finger. Dropping a tiny pink singlet, spitting a peg from her mouth, she scooped Serena Ray from the blanket and stumbled backwards with a little squeal of terror. The snake slid on, over the patchy grass and dirt, towards a weathered concrete slab the size of a couple of tabletops. No one knew the original purpose of the old slab. The base of a garden shed, now demolished? Chook shed? It was cracked and holed here and there, but seemed solid enough. And Jamie had set a garden seat on it, crosswise in one corner, where she liked to read in the sun, shell peas, nurse Serena Ray. The oblivious snake stuck its nose into a hole that seemed to Nathan impossibly small and began, with a series of long, muscular pulses, to squeeze its way under the concrete. Soon a quarter of the body length had disappeared. Jamie and Nathan watched, appalled. Serena Ray popped her wet thumb and pointed.
"Yes, darling. Snake,"
said Jamie shakily. Nathan roused himself from paralysis. A snake, living right beside the house? No fucking way. He ran to the lean-to behind the garage where he stored the firewood and garden tools.
"Nathan!"
Jamie clamped Serena Ray to her chest.
"Where are you..."
"Axe." She gaped, then understood. He was going to chop the snake in two. She watched him vanish, then reappear with the axe, charging the visible half of the snake at a clumsy gallop.
"Don't!"
Panic in her voice. He pulled up, confused.
"What? It could be pregnant."
Something she'd read. Dozens of baby snakes escaping from a severed body, disappearing in all directions to thrive and breed and bite baby humans.
"Plus,"
she said, trying for calm. Nathan looked even more rattled than she felt.
"Snakes are protected."
"What?
Fuck that! And what if this head section comes back out to bite you?"
This seemed unlikely to Nathan, but he hadn't fancied getting close to the snake to begin with, and now it was too late. The snake had disappeared into its burrow. Still, the fact remained. They had a snake. Nathan lumbered back to the lean-to and picked up a couple of old red bricks. Approaching the concrete slab as if it was a bed of hot coals, he skidded across the surface, plonked the bricks over the snake hole and retreated. Brushed the brick dust off his hands and joined his wife, who had withdrawn to the veranda. She seemed unconvinced by his command of the situation.
"What if there's another hole we can't see? What if it knocks the bricks off? What if it digs another exit hole? Jesus, Jamie!"
Nathan resembled any young husband of the district. A little beefy, lawnmower haircut, baggy shorts and surf brand t-shirt. A couple of meek tats, sunglasses perched on his baseball cap. Given to belligerence when he didn't grasp things. Which happened often enough that Jamie had developed a habit of impatience.
"We need to call the snake catcher,"
she said sharply, masking the jitters she still felt.
"Off."
Nathan remembered Serena Ray in time to bite off his words.
She gazed at him as if she shared her mother's view of him. "The number's by the kitchen phone," Jamie went on. Nathan knew that. He'd stuck the snake catcher's name and number there himself after reading a story in the local paper. Baz, the snake catcher, advising residents it was going to be a good season for snakes, particularly copperheads, tigers, and red-bellied blacks. "Nathan," said Jamie, her tone carrying the rest of the sentence. "Okay, okay." He stomped back along the veranda to the front door. Christ, he'd left it open. Who knew how many snakes had slithered into the house? Quick glance back over his shoulder. Jamie was still eyeing the slab, jiggling Serena Ray on her hip. Serena Ray was eyeing him. He gave her a sickly wave, entered the kitchen and dialed the number. Waited. Gazed over his yard to the side fence and neighbor's pine trees and the acres of undulating grassland all around him. All of it crawling with snakes. Eventually, Baz arrived, wearing a blue Snake Catcher Victoria polo shirt, jeans and heavy boots. A cap shaded his face, his big mitts clasped a long crook. Staring from Nathan to Jamie, he said, "Lead the way," as if time were valuable. Nathan indicated the slab and Baz shook his head. "Jesus, you're not making it easy on me, are ya?" That's where it went. Behind them, Jamie said, "Can you catch it?" "Give me a jackhammer and a bobcat, maybe," said Baz. Nathan stood with him, eyeing the slab, and wished he'd just ignored the stupid woman and chopped the fucking snake in half. Should have killed the bloody thing. Baz turned to him, slowly, calmly, and said, "Bud, I didn't hear that. And for sure, I don't want to hear you say it again. It's illegal to kill snakes. You're looking at a $6,000 fine. I'm just saying, well, don't." Baz pointed to the discarded axe. "Even if you chopped it up, the head section is capable of biting you for a long time afterwards." "That's what I told him," Jamie said. Nathan's meaty hands clenched and unclenched. "So what, we just leave it where it is?" "Mate, if it can't get out, it dies," Baz said. "By blocking off the hole, you've in effect killed it. $6,000. You'd report me." "Jesus fucking Christ, what the hell are we supposed to do? We've got a little kid. You're saying we remove the bricks so a venomous snake can roam free and me and my wife and kid barricade ourselves indoors for the rest of our lives?" Baz, unimpressed with Nathan, was nonetheless a fair man. He had kids. He'd even suffered a snake bite 10 years earlier, throwing his family into a panic. He chewed his bottom lip. "Okay, this is what we do. You need that slab for anything? Intend to build a shed on it, for example? You can cart it away for all I care. I'm not carting it away, you are. Or disposing of the pieces once we've broken it up, anyway. I've got a mate, a concreter, specializes in house slabs, verandas, foundations. He'll dig it up, no worries. We'll start at the hole, widen it a bit at a time, enough for me to get an idea what's under your slab, like a big cavity or a network of burrows. Soon as I see a snake, snakes, I'll go to work with me hook." Snakes. Plural. Brilliant. "What do you do with it?" "Them." "Release into the wild." "Right," said Nathan. "And what if your average copperhead has a homing instinct?" "Mate, there are snakes all around us all summer. Most of the time you never encounter them. I get rid of this snake. Who's to say you won't see another one in your garden tomorrow?" Nathan glanced at Jamie. He sighed. "Okay, let's do it." "Might not be today," Baz said, with a troubled look that hinted he didn't like to think of a snake in distress. But Baz's concreter mate agreed to come around mid-morning. So Baz made himself at home. Coffee, Anzac biscuits, and a chin wag on Nathan's veranda, while he waited. Had Jamie in admiring giggles with his snake stories. The prick. Finally, a small truck trundled in, grey as cement. Mick the concreter himself a grey, powdery wreck of a man in shorts, a blue singlet, and heavy boots,
his years of heavy labour manifest in a stooped back and bow legs. He shook Nathan's hand with a crooked, lazy grin full of sly knowledge. Nathan blushed, quite sure Baz had said something to make the concreter think he was a dickhead.
"Here you got a problem," Mick said, releasing Nathan's hand.
"You could say that."
"I did say that."
Mick eyed the slab and rubbed his hands together.
"I've been laying concrete all my life. Not often I get a chance to rip it up."
"Be ready to back off if a head pops out," Baz said.
"Yeah, well, you be ready with your hook thingy," the concreter said.
"Be careful,"
called Jamie from behind the screen door. Mick gave the other men a sleepy look and walked back to his truck to fetch a jackhammer.
"I won't start in the middle," he said, approaching the slab, "in case there's a thumping great hole underneath and I fall into a nest of copperheads. I'll start at one edge, dig out, say, a square half metre at a time, check underneath, move on to the next section. What do you reckon?"
"Go your hardest," Baz said.
Nathan wondered. Prize out each section barehanded. Sooner him than me. Not barehanded. Mick used a crowbar. And after 4 half-metre square sections had been removed, it was clear that a large proportion of the concrete had been poured straight onto bare dirt. Except that as the newly bared edges crept closer to the snake hole, a degree of soil subsidence was becoming apparent under the middle of the slab.
"There he is," Nathan said. Baz nodded. "He's trying to burrow deeper away from us."
"I'll cut out another section," Mick said.
"Yeah, all right. But be ready to backpedal," Baz said. "Our boy won't be a happy chappy."
Mick cut out a small segment of concrete this time, taking in the original hole. It crumbled as he tried to crowbar it out.
"Whoever the fuck poured this didn't know shit about concreting," he said, irritated. "Too much sand, and badly mixed at that."
He reared back.
"Fucking shit!"
The friable concrete had crumbled onto the snake, which tried to strike, but was hampered by the masonry on its coils. Baz darted in and pinned the head with his crook. Then he crouched and used his other hand to flick away lumps of concrete until the snake was free. He picked it up, keeping the whipping front section clear with his crook, and poured it into a hessian sack.
"Piece of cake," he said, grinning at the others,
who were more interested, it seemed, in a depression under the middle section of the slab.
"What? We got a whole family of the buggers?"
He looked. What they had was a rotting cotton shirt over a rib cage, and a wrist bone encircled by a knockoff Rolex Oyster. Chapter 2. Acting Sergeant Alan All was late for work, saying goodbye to his wife. Time alone with her was rare, and it wasn't as if the clients of the cold case unit were clamouring for his attention. "If I'd known I'd been performing cunnilingus," he said, "I'd have shaved more closely." Liz snorted, cuffed him around the ears and yanked on his greying ginger hair.
"Pay attention."
He paid attention, and later they spooned and dozed until Liz said, "I need to finish packing." Falling into kissing, followed by falling into bed, seemed to happen to them once or twice a year. They'd glance at each other, and something, habit, mutual regard, mutual regret, chemistry, the memory of love, exerted a pull. This time All had merely wandered into his wife's room to see if she needed help with her bags. And, after sex, the spooning, the talking, the irresistible slide into sleep. Later, when he returned from her bathroom, which was along the corridor from her bedroom and study, All found her on top of the covers, staring unblinkingly at the ceiling. He'd lost her again. "I didn't so much fall out of love with you," she'd said, tears in her eyes, back when it was clear his general air of distraction and disconnection was never going to change, "as into a different kind of love." Mindful of that now, he bent and kissed her and uttered some banter about the beautiful woman in his bed. Liz blinked, a flinty intelligence returning to her eyes. Last time I looked, it was my bed. And don't get carried away. No. Never that. That wouldn't do at all. Orr left his wife to finish her packing and went downstairs. Chateau Orr, three cavernous stories on a quiet street in Carlton, amplified his footsteps on the stairs and in the hallways. Typically for mid-morning on a Thursday, no one else was at home. Orr's daughter and his tenants and waifs and strays were away until late afternoon. His bedroom was next to the front door. He shared the ground floor corridor bathroom with some of the others. He showered, dressed, made two sandwiches and wrapped one for Liz. And soon she was clattering down the staircase. As she reached the bottom, he stepped into the hallway, one hand offering the sandwich, the other reaching to take her heaviest suitcase. She nodded as though both were her due. A lithe, fluid, dangerously attractive woman dressed in a skirt, t-shirt, denim jacket and running shoes. But gone from him now. Distant, untouchable, focused. Her mind already on her other life. Even so, she was pleasant, almost warm as he carried the bag to her car. No, she wasn't sure when she'd be staying again. Drive safely. Orr ate his sandwich at the kitchen's chipped and grooved wooden table, Radio National Current Affairs barely registering. Her car heads across town, over the Westgate Bridge, down to Geelong. Orr mapped it all the way. At noon, he rinsed his lunch dishes and walked to the tram stop on Swanston Street. A generalized anxiety rode with him down through the city center and across the river to the police complex. Liz, the job, the Elphick sisters calling him this morning, as they did every 14th of October because it was the anniversary of their father's death and they were still waiting for answers he couldn't give. John Elphick, born 1942, found dead of head injuries on his farm in the hills north of Trafalgar in Gippsland, east of Melbourne, 2011. Widower. Lived alone. His daughter Erica lived in Coldstream. A nurse, married to a doctor, three kids. And Rosie was a primary school teacher, living with her long-term high school teacher boyfriend in Bendigo. All had alibis. None had financial woes. No gambling or drug debts. No iffy friends. No secrets that investigating police could find. Besides, Elphick had bequeathed the farm to the Red Cross with his daughter's blessing. His friends and neighbours also had alibis. None had a reason for wanting him dead. And without being the life of the district, John Elphick was well-liked and reasonably active. Lawn bowls, church, an occasional beer in the local pub, an occasional provost meeting. No lady friend. No young farmhands hanging about or in residence. Lovely old bloke, was the general view. And that was the extent of Orr's recall. It wasn't his case originally. He'd been seconded to the team late in the investigation, in the dying days of his marriage and his years in the homicide squad. So you could say he'd been pretty distracted at the time. And he'd retired soon after that. 50 years old, burnt out and sad. But something about him must have appealed to Erica and Rosie, because every 14th of October they'd get together and call him. Just touching base. Any new developments? And every 14th of October until now he'd been able to say he was no longer with the police. It hadn't deterred the sisters. Yes, but you have friends in the police, they'd say. You keep in touch. Not really, he'd say. This morning he'd had to run a different line when the call came. He'd rejoined the police, invited to come back, in fact, ending 5 years of time-killing. Desultory travel, reading, adult education classes, hopeless and or disastrous romantic entanglements, a bit of volunteering for various charities. And somehow the sisters had heard he was back. I was just saying to Erica, Rosie said as Orr chewed his muesli, you're so well-placed now. Extremely well-placed, Erica said. In the cold case and missing persons unit, to be precise, brought in to free up younger detectives for other duties, mainly. Also valued for his 10 years in uniform. 10 in various specialist squads. 10 in homicide. All the retread. Expected to run an experienced eye over unsolved murders, accidental deaths, and missing persons cases thought to be suspicious. Identify those that might now be solved with the benefit of new technology. Identify those that had been mishandled or under-investigated. Those in which new information had come to light. Liaise, where necessary, with other squads, including homicide and major crimes. Push for the retesting of old DNA samples. Have another shot at any alibi witnesses who might have fallen out with the suspects. Track changes wrought by time. A crime scene that was now a car park, for example. A key figure since deceased. Disappeared overseas, suffering dementia, or now married to the chief suspect. Piece of cake. Lizard urged him to take the job. You're made for it, darling heart. She still called him that from time to time. Out of habit, probably. She reminded him what he'd been like back in his homicide days, a case dragging on. Obsessive. In a good way. Meaning he'd agonized that he'd missed something. That a liar had sucked him in. That among the dozens of names he'd collected during an investigation, one was the killer's. We have every confidence, Rosie Elphick had said that morning as all drained his breakfast coffee. I can't promise anything. We know that. The coroner ruled it an accident, I seem to recall. He didn't, though. What he recalled was that Elphick, Jay, hadn't been ruled a murder. There was a silence on the line, a subtle communication of disappointment. Wrong, chided Erica gently. The coroner was quite equivocal. And Rosie said fiercely, read his findings again, please, Alan. All headed straight for the file room when he reached the police complex. Hated that room. Thought they'd find his body in there one day, sandwiched somewhere in the massive compactus. Or stretched out on the floor tiles, one hand reaching, desperate fingernail scratches on the door. Back when he worked homicide, he'd rarely needed cold case files. His cases were hot, or at least tepid. You solved them with shoe leather, phone work, computer searches and questioning. Now he seemed to spend half his time pulling files, and ancient paper files at that. Since the 1950s, 280 unsolved murders on the books of Victoria Police. 1,000 missing persons cases, of which a third were probably murders. Looking this morning for Elphick J, 2011, he rolled 4 grim beige slabs of shelving to the left, creating a narrow aisle. He stepped in, grabbed the firebox and stepped smartly out, half expecting the shelves to abhor the vacuum. Would he even hear a warning rumble? He took Elphick J to the small 10th floor room that was home to cold case and missing persons. The boss was on the phone in her glass cubicle at the far end of the open plan room, door closed. One of the detective constables was in court. The other, Claire Pascal, was slumped at her screen with her back to him. All was content to leave it that way. The first time he'd gone out on a job with Claire, a witness re-interview, she'd got in the car and threatened to blind him with capsicum spray if he laid a hand on her. Dumping the Elphick file box on his desk, he pulled out the contents item by item, scenting the air with a stale mustiness. A bulging file in a rotting rubber band, an envelope of crime scene photos, crime scene video. He eased off the rubber band. It broke. The overview crime scene photos showed John Elphick on his back in thick spring grass at the rear of his Holden ute, parked beside a wire fence. Closer to, the dead man was heavy set with thick white hair, wearing faded jeans, a flannelette shirt and elastic-sided boots. There were gashes to his head and blood seepage on his forehead, cheeks, neck, shirt collar, down inside the shirt. All thought about that. Elphick was upright when he received the injuries? All read every report and statement, then turned to the autopsy findings. Elphick had died of massive head trauma. Blood and skin tissue had been found on the rhubarb of the ute, which tended to argue against murder. But the pathologist had also noted the pattern of blood flow from the head to upper body, and the presence of blood in the cabin of the farm vehicle. He couldn't rule out assault. And for years now, the victim's daughters had politely, gently, tried to convince Orr that he'd dropped the ball back then. "Inclined to agree," muttered Orr now. "Talking to yourself?" Claire Pascal said, still with her back to him. "Sad old bastard." Orr ignored her. Name-calling by the youngsters wasn't going to hurt him. He would do what he'd been hired to do. Next, he slotted the crime scene DVD into his laptop. Photos were useful for close detail, but a video drew you into the scene. You walked through it with the videographer. When you worked a cold case, a video was the best alternative to having been present. All saw a hill slope softened by dense spring grasses, a dam at the bottom, half full, and four nearby gum trees. Distant hills rising to a mountain range in the north and a broad valley to the south. A vista of squares, stripes, dots and dashes that were roads, paddocks, hedges and rooftops. And now here was the wire fence, the ute and the body. At one point the videographer had stood on the tray of the vehicle, the elevation giving all a clearer impression of the body in relation to the fence and the tailgate. "Hope the guy cleared it with the text before climbing aboard," he thought. Pressed pause. Another benefit of the elevation, he could see two sets of tire tracks in the grass. Elphix Holden had arrived at the scene after coming through the gate beside the dam at the bottom of the paddock. The second set of tracks ran parallel to Elphix, but on the other side of the fence. Whoever made them had at some point U-turned and gone back down the slope. All made a note. Check who owns or owned the land next door. He pressed play again. The video now lingered over the body, top to bottom. Soles of the boots, trousers, hands, bloodied head and torso. Then it took him to the cabin of the Holden. Vinyl. The driver's seat sagging, black electrical tape on a couple of splits. Dusty dashboard, also split in a couple of spots. Worn floor mats. Frayed, grubby seatbelts. Air bubbles under the registration sticker. Bottom left of the scratched windscreen. A roofing nail, a paperclip, and a few coins in the open ashtray. Owner's manual, a 2010 phone bill, matches, a pale blue toweling hat, and a pair of pliers in the glove box. In the console between the seats, more coins, Cancer Council sunglasses, a tiny spiral-bound notebook, a chewed carpenter's pencil. All reread the reports. The investigating detectives had not mentioned the notebook. The crime scene manager had. Elphick had used it to jot down rainfall figures, shopping lists, reminders. Buy firewood, service mower, rehang the front gate. All went back to the video. The notebook was closed, the cover creased, faded, coming away from the spiral binding. He pressed pause and enlarged the image. Elphick had scribbled something on the cover of the notebook. Random letters? A number? The pencil strokes were indistinct on the shiny surface. He was dimly aware of Claire Pascal's desk phone, Claire muttering and finally swinging around in her chair. "Oi, retread."
"What?"
"The boss wants us to take a little trip to the country."
"Concerning?"
"Come on," she said testily. "I'll tell you in the car." All stood, shrugged into his jacket, checked for phone and wallet. Pascal wasn't finished with him.
"Don't forget your Zimmer frame."
Chapter 3 All signed out an unmarked sedan and headed onto the Monash, directed by the encouraging voice of the Maps app on Claire Pascal's phone. That voice, he thought she sounded like a Sarah, was his only warm company. Pascal sat centimetres from him, radiating hostility, staring ahead. She didn't want to work a case with him? Stiff shit. Josh Bug, the other youngster, was in court. So unless the boss wanted to get involved, Pascal had no choice. All felt inclined to wind her up further. Keep it down to 60 on the freeway like the old geezer he was. But one of them had to be an adult. The highway unfurled, and then they were on East Link, and grudgingly Pascal was telling him where they were going and why. Some bloke digging up a concrete slab near Piercedale found a body under it. Skeleton. Meaning old and cold. All said. She shot him a look. Meaning the hotshots from homicide have hand-passed it to us. All pricked up his ears, sensing an undercurrent. Personal? He didn't know much about Claire Pascal's home life. Married, that's all he knew. To a cop? Anyway, it wasn't as if he wanted to trade domestic chat with someone who'd warned him off on pain of a face full of capsicum. He glanced at her. Young, fit, capable. Still staring ahead. Her hair scraped back severely, accentuating the sharpness of face and manner. At the same time, she smelt pleasantly of freshly laundered clothes and a tangy kind of shampoo. He didn't mind her. She did call him retread, but fair enough, all thought. These days he felt like a retread, cheaply slapped together, just about guaranteed to wear down quickly. The freeway spooled away beneath the car, and eventually, by pushing, prodding and offering, he got Pascal to open up. They discussed the boss, the Elphick case, a case she was working on. Time ceased to drag. Then, after a long pause, she said, "How come you resigned and joined up again?" And all heard a tone. He had a pretty shrewd idea of the resentments that lay behind the name-calling and obstructiveness he got from the younger cold case and homicide detectives. He was holding back their careers. He was expecting and receiving preferential treatment. He hadn't kept up with technical and investigative advances. Slow, middle-aged, he'd be a liability in life-threatening situations. Not much of that was true, but in the 6 months he'd been on the team, all had stepped on toes and asked hard questions. He'd also laid bare instances of laziness, ineptitude, and inexperience in some of the original investigations. Claire Pascal was probably feeling sidelined right now. He said carefully, "I was approached. Police forces everywhere are rehiring retired cops to work cold cases. It frees up resources." She dismissed that. "The company line. What I want to know is how come you retired in the first place?" "Truthfully? 10 years in homicide, the crime scenes got to me. Awful, some of them. Most of them. You're supposed to grow a shell. I couldn't." She didn't call him a princess, tell him to man up, the kinds of rebukes he'd had leveled at him during his long career. She addressed the windscreen. "It got to you?" "Yep." "I guess looking at old crime scene photos isn't the same." "Nope." She lapsed back into moody silence. Then, near Frankston, as all took the exit onto Peninsula Link, she said suddenly, "I was out of the force for 3 years. "Oh?" "I was on a raid. Ice lab in a house near Melton. I got shoved through a plate glass window by one of my own team. One of the competitive types. Hates to come last." She lifted her right hand from her lap, pulled back her sleeve and floated her arm in the space between all and the dashboard. He risked a quick glance. Forearm scarring. The skin ridged with threads and cords of mangled tissue. "Tendon damage. I've got full use back now, or pretty close. But the surgery and rehab took forever, and I kind of lost it. My nerve." "Shitty thing to happen." "The police medical officer more or less told me to resign on health grounds, which I did. But after a year I couldn't hack it anymore. Rejoined. Applied to go back on my old team. They wouldn't have me. Got sent to a suburban CIU, way out on the other side of the city, with a bastard sergeant who didn't want a woman on his team." She paused. "I learned that the hard way." "Uh-huh." Claire went on as if he hadn't spoken. "Late shifts.
a lot of late shifts, meaning I was alone in the station at the dead of night. Filthy phone calls, strange noises, tyres slashed on one memorable occasion. Another pause. And if I worked days, he'd touch me up. Come-ons and little put-downs the whole time. At least you don't do that. Well, I don't want a face full of capsicum spray, all said. She looked at him blankly, then barked a laugh and blushed. Yeah, well, you know. Ancient history. No hard feelings. Deal, all said. So you applied for a transfer to cold cases. And the rest is history. Not too much history yet, all thought. She'd only joined a month before him. As they rode in silence, most of the tension gone, all let himself daydream. His house, his daughter, his wife. The students and the broken men and women who sometimes stayed a while. And niggling thoughts. Old Mr. Elphick lying on the ground between his farm ute and his boundary fence. The tire tracks. The notebook between the seats. The notebook and the jumble of numbers and letters that Elphick had penciled on the cover. Number plate. Pardon? Sorry, note to self. Old people talk to themselves, Claire Pascal said. I've noticed it before. All laughed, and let Sarah take them to an address east of Pierstale. They found themselves in a land not quite flat, the horizon barely decorated in any direction. Two extremes of human habitation. Older gum trees, broad paddocks and cypress hedges marked the original farm homesteads. Dusty raised lots sprouted the colonnades of Mediterranean mansions, cheap kit homes and low-slung tan brick places with broad verandas. Some shrubs and saplings here and there, a miserable replacement for the gum trees bulldozed to ease the creep of the young families. Boats on trailers, bloated SUVs, satellite dishes. Signs advertised grass slashing, yoga, dog grooming and horse adjustment. Now and then a grazing goat, a horse, an alpaca. A guy tearing around in an ATV with a dog on the back. Finally, Sarah told all to turn left, and he bounced them along a dirt road to an open gate in a white railing fence. At the end of a gravel driveway, several vehicles beside a new-looking house of outdated design, triple-fronted brick veneer with a tiled roof. All made a mental note of the vehicles as he turned in. A small tradesman's truck, a station wagon, a marked police car, a white unmarked, like the one they were driving, a crime scene van, two SUVs in a carport. Several figures came into view, gathered around a blue poly tent, the kind they always put up to preserve the body and conceal it from the media. All slowed the car, bumped over the grass, pulled in behind the crime scene van and they got out, taking a moment to scan the property. Not really isolated, all noted. People bought 5 and 10 hectare blocks out here, meaning they had a sense of isolation, but often were no more than a horse paddock away from their neighbours. And this place had untilled land on all sides, with a hint of red tin roof above wattle trees 300 metres further along the road. The only other nearby structures were an aluminium gardening shed with a lean-to for firewood, and a shiny corrugated shed containing hay bales, a horse float, a trailer, a ride-on mower. Hay bales. All scouted around again and saw two miniature ponies in a fenced enclosure behind the house. The homicide squad was represented by a pair of detective constables, Melissa and Dugan. All knew them by sight. Pascal, better than that.
How's it going, Claire?
Melissa said. He was a slight, strutting character with a strong stink of aftershave. Dugan, a gangly gum chewer, slouched behind with hands in pockets. Melissa went on.
Old retread here showing you how it's done.
Something like that, Claire said. She looked uncomfortable.
Left his Zimmer frame in the car, Dugan said.
All was tired of the Zimmer frame jokes.
Maybe Claire was too. She said, "Yeah, thanks, guys. Hilarious. So, what have we got?" etc., etc.
With Melissa outlining the circumstances leading to the discovery of a skeleton under a concrete slab, they wandered over to the crime scene tent. A slight breeze flowed over the open fields. The tent walls billowed in, out.
"First impressions?" said Orl.
Melissa snorted.
"First impressions, guy. First impressions, the body's been there for a lot of years."
They paused at the entry. All watched a photographer at work. A videographer, two crime scene technicians, the latter thigh-deep in a hole in the ground. All wore disposable forensic examination suits and booties. The skeleton had been lifted out and placed on a tarp, where another tech crouched over it, brushing dirt from the bones. All could see a belt buckle and a scrap of leather, scraps of rotted fabric on the upper torso, around the waist, and on one leg. Running shoes, synthetic, mostly intact. Freya Berg, the crime scene pathologist, knelt on the other side of the remains, watching the brush reveal the bones. She looked up.
"Alan, you on the job again?"
"For my sins." That was enough idle talk. Berg peered back down and said,
"Male, shortish, probably young, going by his teeth. By young, I mean late teens, early 20s, possibly shot. There's a chip out of his bottom left-hand rib, a corresponding chip." She craned her head. "Lower spine. So maybe shot in the chest, the bullet going right through."
All turned to the hole, the excavated dirt and bits of concrete piled beside it. "Metal detector find anything?" The technicians ignored him. Dugan paused mid-chew to say, "Nope."
"Shot elsewhere," Pascal said. She glanced around at the house.
Melissa gave her a twisted grin.
"Hate to disappoint you, Claire, but that gorgeous residence has been there less than 2 years. Same with the sheds."
Pascal pointed at the excavation.
"What about the slab? Used to be what, floor of a shed?"
"Who knows?" Melissa shrugged.
"Thing is..." Dugan chewed his gum, stopping long enough to rub his palms together, slyly satisfied. "Old slab man here is very dead. As in very, very dead. Not our headache."
"Yours," confirmed Melissa. "Slab man," thought Orl. "Everyone's going to call him Slab Man."
"Your boss spoke to our boss."
Melissa grinned.
"Got it in one."
Dugan chewed happily.
"So if you two lovers don't mind, we've got a recently dead carcass up in Lawler. Lebanese on Lebanese, so no great loss. But we do have to hit the road."
"Kind of you," Pascal said. "We aim to please." All nodded at the house, where a man, a woman, and a small child watched from a set of veranda chairs.
"They live here."
"They do," Melissa said.
"And yes, we fucking talked to them," Dugan said. He took out his notebook, tore off a sheet, handed it to Claire.
"They own the joint. Moved in just over a year ago. The house was already here. Brand new, never occupied."
All peered over Pascal's shoulder.
"Nathan Wright, 28, Jamie Wright, 29. Serena Ray Wright, 19 months. Two other names. Baz McInnes, snake catcher. Mick Toll, concreter."
He glanced across at the truck. Two heads aboard, feet propped on the dash, both cabin doors open. They'd be keen to get this done with.
"Okay, thanks," Pascal said.
"Don't tire the old bastard out, Claire," Melissa said. Then they were gone.
"Fuckwits," she muttered. Orr couldn't have put it better himself.
"How do you want to do this?"
"Talk to..." She referred to the paper scrap. "McInnes and Toll first, so they can be on their way?"
"Exactly my thoughts," Orr said.
The snake catcher and the concreter had nothing new to add, but Orr was curious about the snake. Baz indicated the tray of the concreting truck.
"Mate, the poor bastard's been in that wheat bag all morning. I need to release it."
Claire shot a nervous glance at the bag. Took a step back.
Quick question, very quick. Do you know who used to own the place?
No idea. Never been out this way before. Baz turned to his mate, who was rolling a pinched-looking cigarette. Tickled pink at the drama. Mick? The concreter finished rolling, wet the tip, patted his pockets for a lighter. Wouldn't have a clue. Ask the neighbours. Half of police work was asking the neighbours. Claire and all let the men drive away and wandered across the yard to the house, all thinking that properties changed hands regularly in districts like this. A world of small holdings rather than big acreages that remained in a family's hands for generations. Young families moved in, prospered or didn't, moved on again, chasing a different job, a larger or smaller house. Kids finished school and fled to the city for jobs or study, never came back. Claire was on the same wavelength. Might be looking at a few changes of ownership. We might. And it could be days before we know how long the body's been there, so given we're here, let's see what a door knock turns up before we head back to town. She shot him a look. He'd completed her thought. They reached the veranda, where the little family waited in gloomy acceptance of their new state. Under suspicion, the yard a churned-up mess, snakes lurking, death present. Nervous smiles as all introduced himself and Claire. We understand you moved in about a year ago. 13 months, Nathan Wright said. He was late 20s, a large, soft man with freckled, hairless forearms. His wife was also stocky, a scowler, brown-haired with blonde streaks, dangly earrings. The child on her lap eyed the earrings and all tensed, expecting to see a little hand yank hard on one of the pretty baubles. What was here when you moved in?
What you can see, Jamie said, as if it was obvious. House? That big shed? Fences?
We put in the little garden shed, her husband said. You didn't dismantle any old buildings?
Like what?
All said patiently. Was there a chook shed built over the concrete slab, for example? They shook their heads. You didn't wonder what it was doing there?
Not really, the wife said.
She was like her husband, given to the short view, to immediate concerns. Perhaps she was like most people in that regard, all thought. No inquiring minds anymore.
Who did you buy the house from?
Claire asked.
You mean the agent?
Nathan said. A bloke called Tony.
You didn't meet the previous owner?
Oh, right, I get you.
Some agricultural company owned all this.
He gestured at the wider neighbourhood. And they built our house as like a manager's residence. Then they had second thoughts and subdivided. The agent will be able to tell you more, I guess.
Armed with the agent's details, all and Pascal wandered back to the crime scene tent. The air inside was dense, disturbed soil and faint decomposition.
Sweating like a pig in this gear,
Freya Berg said, stripping off her gloves and stepping out of her disposable suit. Someone else will do the autopsy, probably tomorrow or the next day. Meanwhile, like I said, young male with what looks like penetrative injuries.
Shot then, all said. She waggled her hand, non-committal.
Anything in his pockets? ID? Wallet? Keys?
If you're wondering how long he's been buried, not before 2008,
Berg said.
Found a 2008 5-cent coin.
Where was it?
On the ground under the body, possibly originally in the back pocket of his jeans.
Pascal glanced at the remains. Any chance of extracting DNA?
Enough for a profile? Yes.
How are his teeth? All asked.
Intact and in good shape. No filling, so I doubt you can ID him through dental records.
He looked after himself.
He was young, Alan,
Freya Berg said.
Chapter 4. The first responders, a pair of uniformed constables, were still at the house, lounging in the patrol car, looking bored.
Our police force in action, scowled all.
Their senior officer hadn't thought to follow up, and they'd shown zero initiative.
just stayed put. So all cleared it with a phone call to the local station and put them to work. One to drive Claire Pascal in the patrol car, the other to drive all in the unmarked. "That way we cover more ground," he said. "If we're lucky, we might find someone with a long memory." Pascal shrugged. "Soon be peak hour, Alan." "Just until we get a name," all said. "Or names. Going back 10 or 12 years. We could just check property records. There's no hurry on this one." "I get that," all said tensely. "We can spend all of tomorrow looking at databases. But that won't give us local intel. Maybe there was another house here once, and if so, what happened to it? Maybe someone lived here in a caravan, a shed. Maybe someone noticed people coming and going." "You're the boss." He wasn't, but he did have the authority of some experience. "Let's meet back here in an hour." His driver was named Leighton. Young, shy, round-cheeked, mouth permanently ajar. It would take more time than all had to put the kid at ease. They mostly did the house-to-house in silence. A woman with a toddler on her hip answered the first knock. She lived in a kit home, faux gingerbread with a steeply pitched roof, plonked on a raw new lawn. Fruit tree saplings here and there. She remembered the Wrights' house being built. 2, maybe 3 years after we moved here? What was there before it was built? What do you mean? Anything at all, like an old house, sheds. It was just open paddocks, I think. Do you know who owned it? No, sorry. Did you ever meet anyone coming or going when you first moved here? See any activity? Only the builders. A similar story at the next property. An old weatherboard farmhouse. After that, a dusty converted Melbourne tram. Nobody home. Then a 1970s brick house where a teenage girl just home from school said, "Mum and Dad might know, but they don't get back till late." All left his number with her and returned to the car. Leighton started the engine, then sat, looking embarrassed. "What?" said All. "Sir, my shift ends in half an hour." All checked the time. 3:30. Half a kilometre ahead was a garden supply yard. It suggested the presence of a town and other small businesses beyond it. He pointed. "A quick word at the garden centre, then back to your partner, okay?" "Sir." They turned in past heaps of firewood, gravel, mulch and soil. Sheds, a weighbridge, a small high-sided truck. Leighton parked at a log cabin marked Office, and all got out. An old man emerged, wearing overalls, moving stiffly. Stooped, giving all a view of a lumpy scalp under a thin scrape of graying hair. Watery eyes dismissed Leighton at the wheel of the car. Focused on All. "You hear about the body under the slab?" "News travels fast." The man smiled. "How can I help you?" "I'm interested in anything you can tell me about the property. Who owned it? Did anyone ever live on it? Vehicles coming and going, anything at all. Going back 10, 15 years. The old man whistled. "That long? The rest is easy. Bernadette Sullivan owned the place for donkey's years. Then some foreign agribusiness bought it and built the house that's on there now. Then they had second thoughts and subdivided. That's when Nathan and his missus bought it." He paused, cocked his head. "You met her? The missus?" All smiled. "I did." "Then? Tell me about Bernadette Sullivan." "Like I said, lived there for donkey's years, her and her husband and daughter. Then the husband passed on and the daughter got married, and for a while there, before she sold, Bernie went to live with her daughter and rented the old place out." All was confused. "Rented the land for farming?" "No, rented the house." "An earlier house, before the present one." The old man shot him a look. "That's what I've been saying. An old fibro place, there one day, gone the next." "Pulled down?" "Far as I know." "Do you have an address for Mrs. Sullivan, by any chance?"
Won't do you much good. She's dead.
All said patiently, What about the daughter?
Angela. Married and divorced, the old man said.
He jerked his head.
Lives South Frankston way.
Address? Phone number?
Come in the office.
Warped floorboards, ancient calendars, and behind the main counter a potbelly stove and a writing desk crammed with a laptop, a phone, a printer, and a spill of invoices. A large cat was balanced on the thin upper rail of the fire screen. It blinked at all.
Here you go,
the old man said, checking a battered ledger, scribbling onto the back of a torn envelope. Do you remember any of the tenants?
Not really. I think the place was empty for a couple of years towards the end. Before that, a couple lived there, but the bloke shot through on the woman. Not that I blame him. She was ugly as a hat full of arseholes, and nasty with it. Anyway, after a while, she left too. And before that, a family lived there. Freezing place in winter. I was always delivering wood.
But always thinking of the man who'd shot through on his girlfriend. What do you recall about the couple?
Like what?
Names, personalities, incidents. Anything about them that bothered you?
The old man shrugged. They were all right. Argued a bit, apparently.
That's all was getting. You say the house was empty for a time before it was pulled down. How many years before that did they live there?
5, 10?
You wouldn't know where either of them lives now?
Not a clue. Angela might know.
They were the last tenants? The old man looked exasperated.
They could have been. I wouldn't know. All I know is I didn't deliver any more wood to the place after the woman left, okay?
Mid-afternoon by the time All and Pascal headed back to Melbourne, comparing notes. Claire driving. The outer freeway's fast, becoming sluggish by the time they reached the inner city. She had few facts to add to All's, except a name for the woman supposedly left in the lurch by her boyfriend. Donna Crowther. She did babysitting around the district, house cleaning, gardening. The woman I spoke to got quite friendly with her. They still in contact?
No.
Anything about the boyfriend? Claire's eyes flicked to the rearview mirror, the wing mirrors. She changed lanes, a horn blasted, the car twitched. Her hands tightened on the wheel. Sorry. A nervy driver, All realized, riding the brakes. Timid when a bit of push was needed. He rethought his earlier assumption that she avoided driving with a man in the passenger seat and decided she wasn't worried about male criticism or wandering hands. She simply didn't like driving. The boyfriend? He prompted. His name was Sean, and apparently he and Donna were always fighting. In which case there could be records, All said. Police, ambulance. We need his surname. You think it's him under the slab?
We need to rule him out, All said.
Or in.
Find Donna Crowther,
Claire said. Chapter 5. The car logged in. They headed upstairs to the cold case unit, where the boss waved them into her office. There was a vase of coral-tinted roses on the crowded desk. A dozen cards. All said,
Birthday wishes in order, boss?
Helen Colfax gave him a don't-bullshit-me half-smile. The senior sergeant was big-boned and skeptical-looking, wearing black pants today, and one of her range of strangely patterned shirts. Brown hair apparently uncombed, bright red lipstick, an inquiring tilt to her chin. Hers was a face that could stare down a cavalry division. All had occasionally seen her express genuine warmth, especially with victims and helpful witnesses. Otherwise, she was pretty much unimpressed by the world. She appreciated All's long record, but was quick to remind him that A, he'd been out of the game for more than 5 years, and B, this was her show.
Sit,
she said now. Claire Pascal took one of the visitors' chairs. All remained standing,
his shoulder against the jamb. His life was full of futile strategies for countering sedentariness. Not to mention backache, after almost 3 hours in the car.